parameter, if you're at very low temperatures and large values of the tuning parameter, you're in a metallic phase that has a large Fermi surface. And if you start tuning down this parameter to smaller and smaller values, you eventually find yourself in a metallic phase that has long-range antiferromagnetic order. At zero temperature, the two phases are separated by a quantum critical point that, unfortunately, you cannot see experimentally because of the imminent presence of superconductivity. However, there are some signatures that there is something interesting going down there. And so in today's talk, what I'm going to focus on is on the metallic state that is realized at this quantum critical point, which I'm going to call the antiferromagnetic quantum critical method. And understanding the nature of this state is important to shed light on why the superconducting temperature is enhanced at, say, optimal doping in the case of the cuprates, and also to say something about the quantum critical regime, which is related to the strange metallic phase that Subir mentioned this morning. So today's question is, what is the nature of this metallic state? Is it a non-Fermi liquid, or is it a Fermi liquid described by the introduction that Subir did on this morning, whether it's a simple metal or it's something else? Most of you already have an answer in your head, I guess. If not, this wouldn't be interesting at all. So what happens at the quantum critical point? So as you tune this parameter rho, there's a spontaneous symmetry breaking of the SU2 symmetry, and there's a spin polarization that acquires a non-zero expectation value, and in particular, it is spatially modulated. That means that you write your operator as some amplitude that is an SU2 order parameter whose expectation value tells you whether you're in the antiferromagnetic or paramagnetic phase. And it also has a spatial modulation factor that is controlled by its own commensurate wave vector that I'm going to take to be pi pi for the rest of this talk. And also, I'm going to focus on materials that have a C4 symmetric Fermi surface, meaning that they are invariant or they're under 90 degree rotations and reflections. And if this is the case, at the quantum critical point, the Fermi surface of the metal develops what we call hotspots. And these hotspots are simply points on the Fermi surface that are connected by the same commensurate wave vector. So what is the importance of this hotspot? I hope it becomes clear from the following two pictures. Let me just say that what we want to do is to study the long wavelength properties of the quantum critical point, meaning that we want to study the low energy sector of the antiferromagnetic quantum critical metal. So from the fermionic side, it is fairly clear what these low energy degrees of freedom are, which are essentially electrons lying on the Fermi surface. And on the spin fluctuation side are gapless spin fluctuations that carry small momentum Q on top of the commensurate wave vector momentum. Now, what this implies due to momentum and energy conservation is that if you have an electron at the hotspot, it can be scattered into another hotspot connected by the same commensurate wave vector by emitting or absorbing a zero energy spin fluctuation. Now, if you kick the electron a little bit away from the hotspot and then allow low energy spin fluctuations to scatter that electron, it will effectively scatter it into a high energy state.
So another way that you can see this is that if you want to scatter an electron on the Fermi surface to another point on the Fermi surface close to the hotspots, you require high energy spin fluctuations. So what this means is that at sufficiently low energies, the only active players that you will have in your low energy theory are, of course, the spin fluctuations, but also electrons that are very close to the hotspots. Okay, so nonetheless, the electrons that are away from the hotspot are part of the low energy data of the theory. And because there's this sort of decomposition into the theory of hotspots and a theory for electrons that are away from the hotspots, I decided to divide this talk into two. So the first part is a work that I did in collaboration with Sang-Sik Lee and Peter Luntz, and it's based on these three references. This is supposed to be a small review of what we did there. And the second part is where the new stuff comes in, which is something that I've been working with Sang-Sik for a little while. And let me just say that the takeaway messages from today's talk are the following. So the first one is that the antiferromagnetic quantum critical metal hosts particle-like excitations that are described by Fermi liquid theory, but also non-quasi-particle excitations, where that's where the non-Fermi liquid nature of the state will come from. And also, the second message is that despite the fact that there's gonna be superconducting order, there are some non-Fermi liquid signatures that you can still see above the superconducting transition. All right, so let me just go into the first part first. So the low energy theory of the antiferromagnetic quantum critical metal is encoded in this 2+1 dimensional action, which looks very daunting at this point, but I'll go through each of these terms in order to fix the notation and also like give you a little bit of the intuition behind this. And let me say that this is a model that has been studied either analytically or numerically by a large part of the community. Some of the names that are here are actually sitting in front of me. All right, so let me go through every term in the action. So the first term is clearly the kinetic term of the electrons close to the hotspots. The electrons are represented by this Grassmann field psi that carries some hotspot index n that runs from 1 to 8 and some spin index sigma. They also carry Matsubara frequency k naught and two-dimensional momentum that we measure with respect to the hotspots. Now, close to the hotspots, we linearize the dispersion of the electrons, and the Fermi velocity is decomposed in y and x components, which are essentially set by the commensurate wave vector. And the component of the Fermi velocity that is along the commensurate wave vector is set to 1, and the one that is perpendicular is v, which is an important parameter for the rest of this talk. And what v essentially is the slope of the Fermi surface right at the hotspots. Now, the other part of the action, which is the second and fourth term that I had in two slides ago, are essentially the dynamics of the spin fluctuations. Now, in here, phi is an SU2 matrix field that carries some momentum little q on top of the commensurate wave vector. And they have some velocity c, which is another parameter of the theory. And they interact with each other through a phi-4 interaction with some coupling strength u. And perhaps the most important term on today's talk is the one that couples the spin fluctuations with the electrons. And then they are coupled through a Yukawa-like term where if you have an electron at hotspot n, like say around here, it gets scattered to hotspot n bar, which is the hotspot connected by the same commensurate wave vector, by emitting or absorbing a spin density wave fluctuation. Okay, so this is essentially the story behind this big action. And for the rest of the talk, the only thing that I'm going to focus is on two terms rather than the other ones, and I will explain why. But let me just say that if you do a Gaussian scaling analysis of this action in 2+1 dimensions, then you'll find out that G and U are relevant, and therefore any perturbative expansion that you do is essentially going to break. Despite this, we found a way of going around this failure of the perturbative expansion, and we found a non-perturbative solution for this particular theory of hotspots. And I'm just going to tell you without justification what are the main features of this theory. So the first thing is that it is not governed by the Gaussian scaling. It's governed by an interaction-driven scaling. The main difference with the Gaussian scaling comes from the fact that the scaling dimension of the boson field has an order one correction with respect to the Gaussian scaling. Furthermore, the dimension of the fermion field keeps its Gaussian scaling dimension, so meaning that this is a theory that it's dominated by the electrons that have a big feedback on the spin fluctuations, but the feedback of the spin fluctuations on the electrons is rather negligible. Now, under this scaling, what happens is that the bosonic action becomes irrelevant. So in the spirit of the RG, you throw away all irrelevant terms and just keep those that are marginal or relevant in 2+1 dimensions. In particular, it turns out that G under this scaling becomes marginal. And because there is no bosonic term in the action, there's a freedom of rescaling your bosonic field to make this theory depend on a single parameter. And we choose it to be essentially V, which is, again, the slope of the Fermi surface at the hotspots. Now, what is the low energy fixed point of this theory? Well, it turns out that it's characterized by the emergent nesting of the Fermi surface at the hotspots, meaning that V goes to zero. And the fact that V appears here in the interaction term and that it's a small parameter doesn't mean that this is a weakly coupled theory. In fact, the order, the parameter that controls the perturbative expansion is actually G squared over V, which is of order one in our theory, meaning that we are still in the strongly coupled regime, but we just found a small parameter that allows us to tame quantum fluctuations. Now, the dynamics of the spin fluctuations are essentially determined by their interplay with the abundant particle hole excitations, and in particular is given by this damped form over here. You see there's no bare dynamics of the boson in this action, So this comes actually as a solution of to the Schwinger-Dyson equation for the dynamics of the boson in the limit that v is small. And the velocity of the boson is actually fixed by the angle or the slope of the Fermi surface at the hotspot. And when v is small, c is also small. Okay, so this is like the first part of the two-dimensional theory of hotspots. Now, in the rest of the talk, I will be thinking mainly on spectral properties of the electrons in this metallic state. So in the case of the hotspot electrons, if you want to compute the spectral function at non-zero energies, meaning that you're a little bit away from the low energy fixed point, then the quantum corrections that contribute to this spectral function is just these two one loop and two loop fermion self energies. And the reason for that is that higher loop corrections are suppressed in the ratio of V to C, which is a small parameter in the theory. Now, away from the fixed point, your critical exponents are not exact. They have corrections that are of order square root of V. And the fact that there is correction of square root of V have important implications in your physical observables at non-zero energies. So in here, I have the spectral function for the hotspot electrons, meaning at zero momentum, the electrons are right at the hotspot, but at non-zero energy. And it has three contributions. There is the first contribution that is predicted by the interaction-driven scaling, that is 1 over omega. But there is this horrible complicated functions that decay faster than any power law in frequency, which are actually coming from the deviation of the critical exponents from their exact value at intermediate energy scales. So the important message to take from here is the fact that there is no quasi-particle peak in this spectral function, and that means that you have non-Fermi liquid-like excitations. And for the rest of the talk, what I want to do is to actually replace this zero here by a k and try to see what is the spectral function of those electrons that are not at the hotspot, but a little bit away from the hotspot. This is the second part of the talk. And then let me just give you two reasons why we should include the electrons that are on the Fermi surface and not right at the hotspots, even though these are not as strongly coupled as the hotspot electrons. So the first thing is that if you want a theory of a metal, you need to keep all electrons on the Fermi surface in order to have a complete low energy theory, because these are part of your low energy data. And the hotspot electrons are just a fraction of this. So therefore, it seems kind of natural to include the other guys into the picture. And the other motivation, perhaps the most important one, is that I started the talk saying that there's an imminent superconducting transition happening, right? And in what I presented before, I kind of like slipped that under the rug. But the reason for that is that superconductivity is a phenomenon that involves the entirety of the Fermi surface. And for us to answer the question of how this antiferromagnetic quantum critical metal becomes unstable towards superconductivity, we need to understand how electrons away from the hotspots are renormalized by their interaction with the spin fluctuations. So that's the second motivation, if you want, in order to incorporate these guys close to the hotspots, but on the Fermi surface. So what's the logic behind what we did? So the electrons that are on the Fermi surface are actually labeled by the momentum along the Fermi surface. So then it is natural for us to incorporate these electrons by promoting your couplings in the hotspot theory to momentum-dependent functions. So for instance, in the case of the Yukawa coupling, we promote it to a momentum-dependent function that depends on the position of the two electrons on the Fermi surface. And in the case of the kinetic term, what we're doing is simply rewriting our Fermi velocity as a momentum-dependent function whose value depends on the point of the Fermi surface that you look at. And we use a similar decomposition as before. We are decomposing the Fermi velocity along the commensurate wave vector to be some magnitude that depends on the point on the Fermi surface and some slope that it changes as you move along the Fermi surface and tells you how the renormalized Fermi surface will change its orientation. Now, Kn in here, it's not per se the momentum along the Fermi surface. It is, however, the momentum that parametrizes this one-dimensional manifold. And we are choosing notation such that, say, at hotspot 1, the momentum along the x direction is the one that parametrizes this position. And because we are interested in generalizing the theory of hotspots, then at zero momentum, we are fixing our coupling functions to be the same as the ones that we had in the first part of the talk. So this looks nice, but like, what's the goal? The goal is to make a coarse graining to this action in order to find what is the low energy fixed point functional form of these couplings. And generically, this is a extremely hard problem because you cannot actually compute anything if you start with an arbitrary functional form for your coupling functions. However, despite that, we identified a particular limit in which you can understand how electrons away from the Fermi surface get renormalized by spin fluctuations in a momentum-dependent way, and which we have under control. And this is what we call the weak momentum dependence limit, which is essentially, it requires two things for it to be at least analytically tractable. The first one is that you still have control over the theory of hotspots, meaning that there's the slope of the Fermi surface at the hotspots is still going to be a small parameter. And the most important part is that your coupling functions will be slowly varying along the Fermi surface. So if these two things are satisfied, then there is a hope of controlling analytically this functional renormalization group. And in order to explain what we did, let me just tell you what is the UV theory from which we are going to trigger RG flow. So this UV theory corresponds to the one in which you start with a momentum-independent set of couplings, and in particular, your theory is only parameterized by the slope of the Fermi surface at the hotspots, and it's given by V naught, which is a small number, okay? And so in practice, what does this weak momentum dependence limit means? So in practice, what it means is that you're gonna compute your quantum corrections with momentum-independent couplings, and so that will imply that any momentum dependence that you will find in the problem will come through the IR cutoff scales of diagrams. I will explain this in more detail in the following slide. And the way that the observables are obtaining this momentum dependence is through the flow of the zero momentum angle. So the idea here is very simple, is that if you have another scale apart from your running energy that is non-zero, then there's a chance that the flow of your couplings is going to be cut off at that particular scale, and that's the way that the momentum dependence is going to be transferred into the physical observables. So I will go through each one of these three points in more detail. Just let me say that if you follow this kind of logic, then what you find is a stable low energy fixed point up to superconductivity, where the slope of the Fermi surface at the hotspots is zero. So there's, again, emergent nesting of the Fermi surface at the hotspots. And also that there's a weak momentum dependence that is controlled by the bare value of this slope. All right, so why do we want to look into this weak momentum dependent limit, or what is the advantage of doing that? So the first thing is that if you look at weak momentum dependences, you get a lot of things for free. And it's essentially that most of the machinery that we had in the hotspot theory is actually transferred to this setting as well. Meaning, in particular, that the collective mode is described by the same propagator as in the theory of hotspots, and the control parameter of higher loop diagrams is controlled by V over C again. But there's a price to pay, and it's that you cannot control the momentum dependence along the full Fermi surface, but only on an extended region close to the hotspots. Don't mind the scales that appear here. Like, you can ask me later if you're interested. But the point that I'm trying to convey in here is that there's extended region close to the hotspots where there's already a lot of rich physics in terms of how the electronics excitations are renormalized by the spin fluctuations, despite the fact that we don't have control over the full Fermi surface. And here's probably like the crucial point, which is probably the hardest one to explain as well, but just try to bear with me. And it's, where is the momentum dependence coming from if I am computing quantum corrections with momentum-independent couplings? Well, so the logic is the following. So suppose we have the one-loop fermion self-energy. If you compute this quantum correction at zero energy and at zero momentum, this is going to give you an IR divergent term. Now, if you turn on either the momentum or the energy, that IR divergence is going to be cut off. And in particular, the IR cutoff of this diagram will be the maximum in between the energy at which you are probing the system, or if you want this quantum correction, and the minimum energy of the virtual excitations inside the loop, which depends on the external momentum of the electron. So for instance, if you have an electron, say here, on the Fermi surface at some momentum k away from the hotspot, then there are two possible processes that can happen inside here. One of them is that you emit a spin fluctuation of zero energy at the expense of exciting an electron away from the Fermi surface, which is essentially what is happening here. Or you have another possibility, and it's that you keep the electron, the virtual electron, on the Fermi surface at the expense of creating a non-zero spin fluctuation. So there are several momentum scales interplaying in the problem, but it turns out that the minimum energy scale is actually this one, and this is the one that it's going to be important for the momentum dependence of the observables at the end of the day. And it's, again, the reason for this is that the IR divergence of these diagrams are going to be cut off by the maximum between mu, which is the energy scale, and the minimum energy of virtual excitations. So the point that I'm trying to get across from here and in the rest of the talk is that at sufficiently low energies, when you look at non-zero momentum, your quantum corrections become independent of the energy scale. And so what this means effectively is that the electrons decouple from the spin fluctuations at sufficiently low energies. And because of that feature of the theory is that we have natural momentum dependence being generated in different observables as I will show in the rest of the talk. So another point that is that I want to make in here regarding how the physical observables get the momentum dependence is by looking at this equation, which looks a little bit daunting, but the point is that this is the solution to the beta function of the momentum dependent slope on the Fermi surface. And then you see that it depends on the way that the slope at the hotspots flow, and it flows in the logarithmic scale like this. And these theta functions over here basically signal at which energy scale your quantum corrections are essentially, they stop mattering in the sense that it signals the energy scale at which the electron at a given momentum decoupled from the spin fluctuation.
Is the momentum along the Fermi surface?
Yes. Yes.
From half part, that's what KN is measuring?
Yes, yes, that's right. It's not really along the Fermi surface because the way that the axes are imposed are not in a momentum perpendicular and along, but it's one of the momentum that you can use to parameterize the Fermi surface. So in here, I have a diagram of energy versus momentum away from the hotspot, and E1 and E2 correspond to the one loop and two loop fermion self energies that I showed before. And because these are two completely different processes, they have two completely different IR scales, and that's why these lines are not on top of each other. So the logic behind what I'm gonna present in the following is as follows. So suppose you have some fixed momentum away from the Fermi surface, and then you look at high energies and start triggering your RG flow. So you start flowing in energy down in this diagram. When you cross one of the solid lines, that's the point in which the quantum correction stops giving extra contributions, right? And eventually you get into this wide region of this diagram in which your quantum corrections are no longer energy dependent, and they are just essentially depending on the momentum at which you're looking at. Now from this diagram, one thing that I want to point out as well is there's an energy scale, E to the E minus L naught, which signals the point below which the flow of V becomes important and above which you can forget about it. And with essentially this idea in mind, I'm just gonna focus now on the spectral function of the electrons as a function of momentum away from the Fermi surface. It turns out that if you don't have superconductivity in the problem, which you can phrase as the fact that you have control to the lowest energies in your physical observables, then you get only Fermi liquid-like excitations that have infinite quasi-particle lifetime. And the interesting thing is that the quasi-particle weight acquires some momentum dependence. And in regions 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, as you move towards the hotspot, you will see that there's going to be crossovers in the momentum dependence as a consequence of the fact that the one-loop and two-loop quantum corrections do not have the same support in the plane of energy and momentum. So let me just focus on each of these regions and say what's going on. So in region one, when you're like very, very, very far away from the hotspot within the region of validity of the theory, then at sufficient energies below the UV scale at which we are looking at, the electrons are not coupled at all with the spin fluctuations, and therefore the renormalized Fermi surface is given by the bare one, and the quasi-particle weight is just one, meaning there is no interaction. But as you start going into region two and three, the fact that there is a contribution of the one and two loop corrections at intermediate energy scales will generate power law momentum dependencies in the form of the renormalized Fermi surface and in the quasi-particle weight. Now, the power of the momentum is controlled by V0, which is a small parameter in the theory, and therefore this is a weak momentum dependence. Now, what is important in here, at least for me, is the fact that the quasi-particle weight gives us like a interesting characterization of the low energy excitations. So we called cold electrons those that have a unit quasi-particle weight, and lukewarm electrons those that have a power law decaying quasi-particle weight as you approach the hotspot. So this is power law decaying because Kx is much smaller than lambda f. So as you go towards the hotspot, this is a small number for a fixed V naught. Now, if you the reason why there's only a power law comes from the fact that these two quantum corrections here effectively decouple at scales that are much larger than the scale at which the flow of V becomes important. Now, if the flow of V becomes important, meaning if you're looking at regions 4 and 5 at sufficiently low energies, that power law crosses over into either a logarithmic momentum dependence in the case of the renormalized Fermi surface, and a super logarithmic momentum dependence in the quasi-particle weight. So this is a function that decays to zero in a way that is much faster than any power law in momentum. And this is consistent with what I showed in the first part of the talk, where there were no quasi-particles at the hotspot. So in here, what this means is that you have still very well-defined quasi-particles, but as you approach towards the hotspot, their spectral weight is like less and less and less important, up to the point where you get no quasi-particle peak at all. Okay, so this is the ideal scenario. But of course, I cannot ignore the fact that the system is going to develop superconducting order effectively. And again, as I said before, you can phrase this as the fact that if superconductivity kicks in at some energy scale, that's the energy scale up to which your computations are controlled. So if we do that and look at the spectral function at finite energy, still sufficiently small, then the spectral function is no longer necessarily a delta function. It's a little bit broadened. And if superconductivity enters at a scale that is much larger than the scale at which the flow of V becomes important, then there's essentially two things that are going to happen. So the first thing is that in regions 1, 2, and 3, because we're still in the white region of the diagram, spin fluctuations decouple from the electrons in this region, and therefore the spectral function here will be a delta function as a consequence of the electrons having an infinite lifetime. But if you enter into region 3 prime and what I call the no resolution region, something more interesting happens. And it's that you actually lose all momentum dependence, and the quasi-particle weight depends as a power law on the renormalized energy omega, and the lifetime is inversely proportional to the quasi-particle energy. And this is a deviation from Fermi liquid theory. So this implies a scattering rate that increases linearly with the energy, while Fermi liquid theory should or tells you that it should increase as the square of the energy. And this is something that has been observed in marginal Fermi liquids. Now, the reason why we lose momentum dependence in here is quite simple. It's just a statement of the fact that you're not looking at sufficiently low energies to disentangle the momentum details of the interaction between the electrons and the spin fluctuations. So it's natural that in here, what you will see along this no resolution region is something that it's momentum independent. And in particular, the quasi-particle weight is reduced compared to unity dramatically. Now, what happens if superconductivity kicks in at energy scales that are below the scale at which the flow of V becomes important? Well, the story keeps being the same as in the ideal case for regions 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, so meaning the white part of this diagram. And in region 5 prime and in the no resolution region, you again lose some idea of the momentum dependence of the interaction, and therefore your quasi-particle weight and quasi-particle lifetime are going to be momentum independent, and they only depend on the quasi-particle energy. The only difference with the previous case is that now your quasi-particle weight will have a superlogarithmic dependence on the quasi-particle energies. And I should stop using the word quasi-particle because these are not coherent particle-like excitations. And the reason for this is that the scattering rate scales again linearly with the energy omega, the renormalized energies, up to some logarithmic correction that comes from the emergent nesting of the Fermi surface at the hotspots. So just to finish, let me state again my two takeaway messages, and it's that the antiferromagnetic quantum critical metal has both Fermi liquid-like and non-Fermi liquid-like excitations. In the ideal case, basically the full extent of the Fermi surface has essentially Fermi liquid-like excitations, but they have a momentum-dependent quasi-particle weight that vanishes as you go towards the hotspot. And we have some classification, if you will, of this type of excitations as cold, lukewarm, and hot, and these are in one-to-one correspondence to the momentum dependence of the quasi-particle weight. And again, despite the fact that there's superconductivity, at least one of the non-Fermi liquid signatures that you could see is the way that the quasi-particle lifetime scales with the renormalized energies. And as if you were probably not, but I should mention it, like paying attention to these scales over here, which I didn't explain, let me just say that L naught is a very large number, which is of order 1 over V naught. So what this means is that the lukewarm portion of the momentum space, or that portion where you can see lukewarm electrons, is extensive, and the part where you see hotspot electrons is exponentially small. So that means that if we want to compare things to RPS experiments, we should expect only physics consistent with lukewarm electrons, apart from the fact that if you look right at the hotspot, then you'll see the incoherent nature of the quasi-particles, or, well, not the quasi-particles, the excitations. There's no quasi-particles. Yeah, so I hope I made sense, at least in the first part of the talk.
What is the process that led to this linear energy dependence of the lukewarm electrons? Can you summarize that?
Okay, so
which is the graph, which is the Feynman diagram?
Right. So if you compute just the first thing is that the quasi-particle lifetime as well as the quasi-particle weight are dominated only by the one-loop Fermi self-energy in this region in particular. So
this is all analysis of one-loop self-consistent one-loop theory.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. So the reason why the two-loop diagram doesn't do anything in here is because, let me just put it over here.
Which you have a picture of the diagram?
Yeah, it's this guy. This is the guy that will lead to the omega, the linear in omega dependence,
okay,
where this guy is given by the self-consistent propagator of the hotspot theory. Let me just say something that it's also important that I kind of like didn't mention, but it's not only proportional to omega, it comes with a power of V naught. So if you want to see what the ratio of the maximum of the spectral function to this thing is, which will give you an idea of the coherence of the particle-like excitation, it's kind of parametrically small, or not large, as V naught becomes larger and larger, meaning that the peak is kind of well-defined, but not really. So to call it a true Fermi liquid, this should be omega squared. This is just, I guess, larger scattering rate at low energies. And I think this is a direct consequence of the strong coupling between the electrons close to the hotspots and the spin fluctuations.
Any other questions?
Okay, if not, it's here for me.